following my presentation will, sounds like a sacrament meeting, but will be favored by a musical number. A panelist, Lisa Cannon, will sing and play the guitar, a hymn that I'll let her introduce that I think echoes the theme of our need to practice social justice. Lisa is born in Germany and grew up in Laguna in Southern California, and she was educated at Brigham Young University Law School. After Lisa, we will hear from Albert Peck. As many of you know, Albert is the editor of Sunstone, and Albert was born in Salt Lake City and educated at Brigham Young University, and I think contributes to our intellectual and spiritual life, each issue, by his thoughtful comments from the editor's column. He will address the topic of how we can create surpluses in one's time, talents, and money to be able to consecrate them to others. Finally, Allison Amaker, who was born in Kentucky, educated at Brigham Young University, and who is a member of the fundraising board of the West Side Center for Independent Living, and formerly acted as the Christian Community Service Leader for the Los Angeles First Ward, here will provide us with her reflections and observations on how we can succor the needy and the particular projects that she's been involved with. And she also, I think, is going to turn some of the time over to other people who have been involved in projects that have been designed to succor the needy. I guess by your presence here, you certainly are not of those who think that succoring the needy means becoming a new skin distributor or some other multi-level marketing scheme. The King James translation uses the word judgment as one of the weightier matters of the law that Christ chastised the Pharisees for neglecting. The New Revised Standard Version of the Bible and other modern translations don't use the word judgment as the King James Version, but uses the word justice. What did Christ mean by this word justice? In our own religious tradition, as we heard last night, Gene England, and particularly in Mormon rhetoric, justice is virtually always portrayed as the victim of robbery perpetrated by mercy. This is regrettable, I believe. First, because I've always felt that, like Robin Hood or a good robber, mercy can and should rob justice. After all, that's what mercy does. Second, I think the two terms are often typically juxtaposed in a false dichotomy to try to explain how or why the atonement works. I've always felt that this usage is unsatisfying because, personally, I believe, as the heretic Abelard, that the atonement is a process which occurs within the disciple of Christ rather than an event which purports to balance some abstract ledger book of the universe. I submit that Christ, when he used the term justice in Matthew 23:23, which is the scripture I'm alluding to, was not using this in the balance sheet sense. And even though, as a lawyer and my own legal training might prefer it, I don't believe that Christ was referring to the legalistic sense of the word. Justice here, and used by Christ in Matthew 23, does not mean the determination of rights according to legal principles, such as the axiom, an eye for an eye or a tooth for a tooth. Rather, Christ was admonishing the scribes and Pharisees to practice justice as it was expressed elsewhere in the Mosaic Law. Christ's admonition to practice justice calls to mind the aspects of the law that addressed socioeconomic inequality among God's people. According to Professor Moshe Greenberg, a professor of Bible at Jerusalem's Hebrew University, a clear intent of the Mosaic Law was to diffuse material resources more equally. He, in fact, Greenberg argues that the whole purpose of the law was to diffuse economic, political, and religious power so that such power could not be concentrated and abused, thus becoming a challenge to God's authority. Under the Mosaic Law, the prohibition of interest on loans, the emancipation of slaves every seventh year, the commandment not to harvest crops so the poor could collect and eat the food, and the mandated celebration of Jubilee, where title to parcels of land sold in the prior 50 years reverted to the original owner, all militated against economic concentration and grossly unequal distributions of income. Catholic commentary on the Mosaic Law is remarkably in accord. Central to the biblical presentation of justice, U.S. Catholic bishops wrote in a recent pastoral letter, is that the justice of a community is measured by its treatment of the powerless in society. The law and other writings of the Old Testament share deep concern for the proper treatment of these people. They are vulnerable and have no protector or advocate. God hears their cries, and the king, who is God's anointed, is commanded to have special concern for them. So wrote the Catholic bishops. Obviously, to many of us, this might be a new view of justice. But if in fact Christ is advocating this view of justice, then we have to accept a new obligation. Christ not only said that this was something we must do, but he said it was a weightier matter of the law. So by using these words, he added, in my view, he added to the pecking order of commandments beyond the two greatest. He told us that we are to pay tithes, which he specifically refers to in Matthew 23, and obey other commandments, but to do justice is more important, is a weightier matter of the law. The need to enlarge our vision of responsibility is well as illustrated in an insightful article written in 1990 by Professor Richard E. Johnson, which appeared in BYU Today, and it was entitled Socioeconomic Inequality, the Haves and the Have-Nots. It was a remarkable article in which Johnson criticizes those in the church that lament the declining moral state of contemporary American society by defining morality too narrowly. Quote, "We might gain valuable insight," he writes, "by broadening the measure of morality beyond the traditional sins, sex, crime, drugs, and violence, to include such variables as poverty, homelessness, and socioeconomic inequality." To Johnson, the most powerful and consistent scriptural warnings given to those who live in the last days, particularly in the Book of Mormon, center around the evils of materialism, consumerism, worldly vanity, and socioeconomic inequality. When measuring morality by these less conventional measures, we do have a reason to lament the contemporary state of America and the world. Despite the extravagance and wealth creation in America during the 1980s, or perhaps because of it, the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer. According to Census Bureau statistics that Johnson cites, the richest one-fifth of American households now receive almost 10 times the average income of the poorest one-fifth, and that's the highest ratio of inequality at any time since World War II. Moreover, the top one-tenth of U.S. households now own 70% of the wealth. I was just reading the other day in the New York Times a new report, also from based on U.S. Census, said that the U.S. middle class is shrinking. The conclusion is obviously, a report released by the Census Bureau on Thursday shows that the percentage of Americans with middle incomes dropped from 71% in 69 to 63% in 89. The conclusion is obviously that inequality has grown rather substantially over the last 20 years, says Jack McNeil, the Census Bureau economist who wrote the report. In addition to widening income disparities, U.S. infant mortality rates are also rising, and among America's poor now exceed those in many third world countries. The percent of Americans in poverty increased significantly during the 80s, such that now there are more than 33 million Americans who live in poverty. Many of these are poor. Many of the poor are single mothers and their children. We've heard about the feminization of poverty from other speakers. In fact, almost one-fourth of all children in the United States today live under the poverty line. For many of these children, basic health care is lacking. Measles vaccinations for poor children in the United States now lags far behind other developed countries. The rate of homelessness also continues to grow. The traditional homeless, alcoholics, addicts, unemployables, have been joined by single mothers and their children, working poor, and deinstitutionalized mental patients. All of this in a country of great material wealth. In the world at large, the injustice further abounds. At least 15 million children under the age of 5 die of starvation each year. Roughly one child every 2 seconds. Millions more will sustain physical and mental impairment because of malnutrition. Billions of persons live in absolute poverty, and the gap between rich and poor is striking. When I reflect on Christ's admonition to do justice, to right moral wrongs, I cannot ignore these statistics of affliction, suffering, and inequality. I cannot help but rehearse Christ's words, "Then shall they also answer him, saying, Lord, when saw we thee an hungered, or athirst, or a stranger, or naked, or sick, or in prison, and did not minister unto thee? Then shall he answer them, saying, Inasmuch as ye did it not to one of the least of these, ye did it not unto me." I recognize that some might argue that inequality of income is beyond the scope of religious obligation and doing justice. To such people, I would simply cite the remarkable yet chilling revelations found in the Doctrine and Covenants. In section 49, verse 20, "But it is not given that one man should possess that which is above another, wherefore the world lieth in sin." Doctrine and Covenants, section 70, verse 14, "In your temporal things you shall be equal, and this not grudgingly. Otherwise, the abundance of the manifestations of the Spirit shall be withheld." And Doctrine and Covenants 78, verse 6, "For if you are not equal in earthly things, ye cannot be equal in obtaining heavenly things." These scriptures, to me, demonstrate the inextricable link between righteousness and economic equality. Indeed, it is no coincidence that in those few instances in sacral history, when God's people have reached a higher level of righteous living, in each instance, their communities have taken action against poverty and inequality of income. Thus, the Book of Moses records that in the city of Enoch, the Lord called his people Zion, because they were of one heart and one mind, and dwelt in righteousness, and there was no poor among them. Later, in Jerusalem, after the Holy Ghost had descended on the disciples during Pentecost, the Book of Acts informs us, quote, "And they continued steadfastly in the apostles' doctrine and fellowship, and in breaking of bread, and in prayers. And all that believed were together, and had all things common, and sold their possessions and goods, and parted them to all men, as every man had need. Neither was there any among them that lacked." Finally, in the Western Hemisphere, after Christ's visit, the Book of Mormon records, "And it came to pass in the 36th year, the people were all converted unto the Lord upon all the face of the land, both Nephites and Lamanites, and there were no contentions and disputations among them, and every man did deal justly one with another, and they had all things common among them. Therefore there were not rich and poor, bond and free, but they were all made free and partakers of the heavenly gift." Having seen that Christ himself has admonished us to do justice, and noting the salutary effects on those communities of saints who the scriptures record did in fact act justly, it should be clear that it is our responsibility, both the church as an institution and each member individually, to work for justice in this world. While the church's activities cannot substitute for individual action, the church should take a leading role in creating justice. It should be recalled that Christ was chastising the ecclesiastical leadership of his day those who sat in Moses' seat when he admonished them not to ignore the weightier matters of the law. It was they who were under obligation to observe the weightier matter. The contemporary church is subject to the same obligation. Regrettably, this critical element seems to be omitted from the oft-expressed threefold purpose of the church: preaching the gospel, redeeming the dead, and perfecting the saints. Doing justice or succoring the needy just doesn't seem to fit into any one of those categories in my mind, and I would suggest that perhaps we need a new fold, or at least a new wrinkle, to accommodate this paramount objective of the church. Christ's own life demonstrates so vividly that one of the church's principal roles should be to combat poverty, homelessness, world hunger, and malnutrition, and socioeconomic inequality, and to use its other influence, resource, moral suasion to condemn and oppose these evils and other forms of injustice throughout the world. In this regard, we as a church can learn much from the intellectual traditions of our Catholic brothers and sisters. Last year marked the 100th anniversary of the first modern Catholic social teachings. On May 15, 1891, Pope Leo XIII issued the Church's first collection of social teachings in a document entitled Rerum Novarum, The Condition of Labor, which addressed the then pressing problems of industrialization and the oppression of workers. This rich Catholic tradition continued with Pope Pius XI's 1931 publication of the Reconstruction of the Social Order, which responded to the impact of the economic depression by condemning unequal distribution of wealth and opposing both unrestricted capitalism and Marxism. More recently, in 1971, the Synod of Bishops released a significant encyclical entitled Justice in the World, which declared, "Action on behalf of justice and participation in the transformation of the world fully appear to us as a constitutive dimension of the preaching of the gospel." In the same encyclical, the bishops also declared that action for justice is a central part of the church's mission for the redemption of the human race and the church's purpose to liberate humankind from every oppressive situation. Cardinal Roger Mahoney also just recently in a speech declared that we cannot call ourselves Catholic unless we hear and heed and then embody the church's call to serve those in need and work for justice and peace. The Catholic bishops also taught that the gospel demands justice for these people, the poor, the illiterate, the hungry, as an essential expression of Christian love. To love God is to love our neighbor, and this love of neighbor cannot exist without justice. Finally, one very recent example of Catholic social teaching is the pastoral letter written in 1986 by the U.S. National Conference of Catholic Bishops entitled Economic Justice for All. This letter, citing many of the same statistics of economic inequality in the United States that Professor Johnson does in his article, concludes that, quote, "Basic justice demands the establishment of minimum levels of participation in the life of the community for all persons. Basic justice, or biblical justice, as the Catholic bishops write, consists of three dimensions: commutative justice, distributive justice, and social justice. Commutative justice calls for a fundamental fairness in all agreements, exchanges between individuals or private groups. It's a call for fair wages and working conditions. Distributive justice requires that the allocation of income, wealth, and power in society be evaluated in light of its effects on persons whose basic material needs are going unmet, reflecting the Second Vatican Council's statement that the right to have a share of earthly goods sufficient for oneself and for one's family belongs to everyone. Finally, social justice, which implies that persons have an obligation to be active and productive participants in the life of society, and that society has a duty to enable them to participate in that way. Or in the words of Pope Pius XI, quote, "It is of the very essence of social justice to demand from each individual all that is necessary for the common good." As a church, we need to embrace the spirit of this Catholic social teachings. LDS bishops who are responsible for the temporal welfare of the church should join together with Catholic bishops in teaching justice. How this abstract value can be translated into a concrete practice, of course, is more problematic. Reestablishing pioneer Orderville's on a large scale may not be realistic, but recapturing and teaching the spirit of egalitarianism is. The church welfare system, as remarkable as it may be, could be used to create more justice beyond helping our own needy. There are no doubt countless other ways in which the church's welfare aims can be broadened. I should point out, though, in the past 5 or 6 years, at least one part of the institutional church seems to share this vision. Under the direction of Presiding Bishop Glenn Pace and Apostle Thomas Monson, a small group within the church's welfare department, known as Humanitarian Services, has transformed the church's aid program from an isolated disaster relief aimed primarily at church members to participation in a wide range of ecumenical humanitarian assistance and development directed at both disaster victims and the poor and the homeless. Christian international relief organizations, which used to assume the church would never work together on such relief projects, now communicate and cooperate frequently. Joint efforts with local food banks, shelters, and literacy projects are common now. Even non-proselytizing service missionaries are being called to serve Peace Corps-like missions. In addition to our responsibilities as a church, we as individual members also face a challenge, as David S. King expressed it, of translating our love of mankind and desire to do justice from a theological abstraction into a practical instrument for servicing human needs. First, of course, we must acquire the will to bear one another's burdens, even the burdens of those unknown to us. Our resolve must project beyond our immediate families, congregations, and fellow citizens, and indeed stretch to the ends of the world. Joseph Smith once said that a person filled with the love of God is not content with blessing his family alone, but ranges through the whole world, anxious to bless the whole human race. As one who believes in the efficacy of prayer, I am convinced that making this a subject of our daily prayers is absolutely vital. Even as we expand the scope of our empathy, it is clear some may find it easier to work for a more just society by striving to eradicate poverty and homelessness in the local community. I was just in another session where we were talking about, where Bob Reese was talking about various people who have actively worked towards creating social justice. And someone in the audience raised their hand and said, why don't we have those kind of people in the church? And Bob's response was that I think that we do. And I would agree. Lowell Bunyan is someone that I've often equated sort of Mormonism's answer to Mother Teresa. The efforts of Lowell Bunyan and others like him, I think, are a fine example of the spirit of volunteerism at work. Others target their relief efforts in international development programs. There's an outstanding example of one of these organizations in Utah is set up and run by Utahns of a variety of religious and non-religious affiliations. It's called the Walesabugu Utah Alliance, which is an organization which fights human suffering in the West African country of Mali. Second, we must resist the sophistry that argues because we can't help everyone, we should not act at all. Every little bit helps. We must personalize the problem, address it at all levels. And we've got people that are going to give you sort of a blow-by-blow description on how we can actually use our energies to work in that direction. Third, even though we as Christians have a duty to assist the poor through acts of charity and voluntary action, these are not sufficient by themselves. Our direct individual efforts on a small scale must be corroborated by collective efforts on a large scale. We must, as the Catholic bishops have said, quote, carry out our moral responsibility to assist and empower the poor by working collectively through government to establish just and effective public policies, unquote. Although government involvement in social issues may seem inappropriate to some Mormons, interestingly, the 1939 Melchizedek Priesthood Study Guide noted that all capitalist systems create inequalities of ownership and income and require public policy initiatives to correct such abuses. It specifically, the Melchizedek Priesthood Study Guide, 1939, specifically called for a system of progressive taxation, quote, so that everyone will contribute according to their financial ability. It also called for progressively higher estate and inheritance taxes to prevent the intergenerational transfer of wealth, and that the, quote, so-called idle rich who have been living on the earnings of past generations will be no more, unquote. It'd be nice to have the good old days back, huh? This is but one way public policy might be adopted to address partially this wide-ranging problem. Other policy initiatives directed at ameliorating poverty, homelessness, and hunger demand our active support. The prophet Isaiah proclaimed that peace is the work of justice. Let us strive toward the fulfillment of the words of the psalmist. Mercy and truth have met together. Justice and peace have kissed each other. Thank you.
I love the scripture that where it talks about you can have faith and you can have hope, but if you don't have charity, then it's all for nothing. If you don't visit the sick, needy, and afflicted, it's all for nothing. This is a poor wayfaring man of grief, and it was one of Joseph Smith's favorite hymns, and it's become one of mine too.
A poor wayfaring man of grief hath often crossed me on my way, who sued so humbly for relief that I could never answer nay. I had not power to ask his name, whereto he went or whence he came. Yet there was something in his eye that won my love, I knew not why. Once when my scanty meal was spread, he entered not, a word he spake, just perishing for want of bread. I gave him all he blessed it break, and ate but gave me part again. Mine was an angel's portion then, for while I fed with eager haste, the crust was manna to my taste. I spied him where a fountain burst clear from the rock. His strength was gone, the heedless water marked his thirst. He heard it, saw it hurrying on. I ran and raised the sufferer up, thrice from the stream he drained my cup, dipped and returned it running o'er. I drank and never thirsted more. T'was night, the floods were out, it blew a winter hurricane aloof. I heard his voice abroad and flew to bid him welcome to my roof. I warmed and clothed him, cheered my guest, and laid him on my couch to rest, and made the earth my bed, and seemed in need. wounded, beaten, nigh to death, I found him by the highway side. I roused his pulse, brought back his breath, revived his spirit and supplied. Wine, oil, refreshment, he was healed. I had myself a wound concealed, but from that hour forgot the smart and peace bound up my broken heart. In prison I saw him next, condemned to meet a traitor's doom at morn. The tide of lying tongues I stemmed, and honored him mid shame and scorn. My friendship's utmost zeal to try, he asked if I for him would die. The flesh was weak, my blood ran chill, but my spirit cried, yes, I will. Then in a moment to my view, the stranger started from disguise. The tokens in his hands I knew. The Savior stood before my eyes. Of me he spake, and my poor name he named. Of me thou hast not been ashamed. These deeds thy shall thy memorial be. Fear not, thou didst them unto me.
Ever since my mission, where I was really first introduced to the concepts of the church, one of the church's main missions being the establishment of Zion and our commitments to work for that end, of which Cole read some scriptures that describe that, I've always begun thinking of about the law of consecration and stewardship, which, of course, is very tied into it and was a program the Doctrine and Covenants discusses quite extensively to achieve Zion, at least one major aspect of Zion, the economic and social aspects of equality, and which is in the context of many of the scriptures quoted from the Doctrine and Covenants. In the last several years, I've gained an increased desire to want to simplify my life and work more for issues on community and working for peace and social justice in the church and in the world. And that has not been an easy trial, and I'm still working very hard on just even doing things. But my task tonight is to just talk about the dynamics of creating time to work on the issues which Cole talked about being so important, and which Allison, following me, will give us more specifics. When I distill what I think consecration and stewardship mean, I think, as we're aware, in church history there were many different attempts. Sometimes people would give their property or lands and deeds to the church and they would give it back to them, and other times the church would keep it and keep the deed to it and just give people back a stewardship of it. But in any event, however it was managed, people were to take what they had as their stewardship and to manage it so that they would provide for their legitimate wants and needs, and also create a surplus that would then be given back to the bishop's storehouse system, so that that surplus could be used to set other people up in self-sustaining stewardships that then could, which would then create surpluses which would help create other people. That general system was one that would, to use another quote from the Doctrine and Covenants, exalt the poor and abase the rich, and help us be equal temporarily, that we might be equal spiritually. Covenanted, temple covenanted Mormons are under no less compulsion to try to live a life of stewardship and consecration today. And while the church doesn't give us a stewardship, we have a stewardship given to us by God, which is the time we have here on this earth and the talents God has blessed us with and the other conveniences we have and the money with which we have. And that is our stewardship, of which we must be held into account. And similarly, we need to manage that so that we provide for the legitimate needs and wants of ourselves and our family and those for whom we have responsibility, but that we also manage it and husband our stewardship so that we create a generous surplus to help build the kingdom, run the church, and exalt the poor. That has not always been easy. In fact, we're familiar with the... let me move on from that. That's the point. That's how I've tried to view my life, is I need to manage it so that I create a surplus. And in theory, I thought, well, that's an easy thing to do. Historically, it's been hard in the church to do. In fact, you know the story of when they were living the law of consecration, Joseph Smith sent Brigham Young around to get everything, and the only thing he could find was a cow that would no longer give milk. That was the surplus that the church had. Of course, then they were all poor, so there may have not been much of a surplus. But they lamented that no one, even back then, could create a surplus. That's how we got the law of tithing. Historically, people came to Joseph and said, give us a minimum percentage of a stewardship. Is it 3%, as some were talking about, is it this percent? And if you read the section, was it 69? What was the section of the law of tithing? That's the question. What is an acceptable surplus? It's first to consecrate everything, all your surplus, and then from then on, 10% of your increase. And that's the context of how we got the law of consecration. It was a minimum surplus because we had a hard time creating anything otherwise. And so, in one sense, Mormons who tithe completely are creating a minimum surplus, which is used to, in many ways, to help through the church's welfare system as well as its other programs. So I've tried to create more of a surplus for my life. I've found that it basically requires an act of self-denial. To say, when I'm at a record store, do I want the CD, or do people who don't have any food or clothing really want this $15 more? And I play guilt trips on myself all the time. But managing a stewardship for a surplus means denying oneself. Fundamentally, I think it means lowering our standard of living. Thanks. Lowering our standard of living so that others may raise their standard of living. And that's harder to do than to talk philosophically about helping the poor. And let me tell you a couple of my aborted attempts to do this. One time I was developing a budget, which people who know the Sunstone office know I have a very hard time even keeping track of the checks I write for Sunstone, but where I would list in one column, as I plan my budget, my wants, my legitimate wants. We're very fortunate that Mormonism allows us to not have to totally base ourselves that we have nothing. We have responsibilities to provide for legitimate want. Excuse me. I would outline my needs first, my needs, and then my wants, and then I would plan the surplus. And tithing would be included in that, and other charities I'd like to give money to and things. But I found that it was very difficult to create anything that it was even a moderate surplus. You know, even modest needs, as I would define them, would gobble up, you know, a good part of the surplus. And so I revised that. I decided, well, I can't do needs, then wants, and then surplus, because I never have any surplus. Surplus has to come before needs. So, before wants. Yeah, you got where I'm going. So I would, here we go. I would say, and as I plan my budget, and for a long time I'd keep record of every money and outline what column it fell into. I would go, my needs first, and then a surplus. How much do I want to create for a surplus? And then, what are my wants? And of course, you have a very hard time determining, are savings needs, or are they wants, or this is, you know, is eating out, what is, how much of that is a basic need, and how much is a lavish restaurant you know, a want, you know. And but the principle is an important one to struggle with. But even then, I had a hard time with this process where I came from. But I think it's an important process, and I think there is a principle, a spiritual principle involved here, which is that in creating one surplus, it's important for us to stretch enough and to deny ourselves so that there is some kind of hurt in the denial, that we deny ourselves something that we really do want and have to give up. I think that's the lesson of the widow and her mite. When the rich man comes and gives a lot of money, but he still has a lot and is very comfortable, and the widow comes and gives one coin, and it's all that she has. It's that she has denied herself for others when she gave the coin to the pot to help the needy. So that kind of stretching is an important one. Just this year, however, I read a book by Albert Schweitzer called A Place for Revelation. And in it, he has one chapter where he discusses this dynamic. He for several pages, he deliberated on how can one justify expending any of one's resources on any kind of extravagance beyond basic needs to live when other people have nothing. Particularly if you consider that everything we have is the Lord's, and he wants it distributed to help everyone. How can we even, in good conscience, you know, come to a symposium like this, or do anything like that? And Schweitzer doesn't have an answer to that very difficult moral question. But he does have a program. He says, maybe there aren't hard answers on that. But the struggle of dealing with those issues are very important issues, and we should never become immune to that struggle within ourselves. But he also recommends a strategy. He says, beyond the essentials of what you need to live, your rent for a modest place and your necessary clothing to work in whatever occupation you have and essential foods to live, it says, any dollar you spend on luxuries on yourself, you should donate an equal dollar to someone else. It's an easy arithmetic to follow, he says. And then he went on with some examples. He says, you know, if you go out and eat an expensive meal at a restaurant, he says, then give equivalent money to a food bank program so that others may have basic meals. And if you indulge yourself in nice entertainment, which is a very worthy thing to do, these are worthy goals to do, says, then you should, you know, perhaps give money to something like Toys for Tots or something. Well, you don't have to do the equivalent of what you eat. The point is that with whatever you have beyond that, you proportionate so that you're creating a surplus for people. And I actually have been experimenting with that this year. And it's been a very difficult thing for me. I have come to the conclusion of a quote I recently read, that even the most bleeding heart liberal lives in the largest house they can afford. And, you know, we all live up to and just sometimes beyond our income, and it's very hard to deny ourselves things. Things that are of inherently, that have an inherent good worth. Music, good books, good things. But it is important for us to not only cultivate those talents we have, but to deny some with that. And I could go in more into that dynamic, which so far in this year, it was a New Year's resolution, it has not been a great success in my life. But the struggle has been important, and it has struck my conscience, which is why I was very interested in this panel that Cole came up with. So that's an idea. The point is, my whole point is, the Mormon concept of law of consecration and stewardship, of creating a surplus, is very helpful in when we're thinking of terms of working for social justice, because the law of consecration is to create a surplus to help exalt the poor. This not only applies to money, which is what I primarily talked about, but, of course, to the other two things we consecrate, our time and our talents. And sometimes it's harder to create space for those than it is for money, particularly for people who are very busy and fairly affluent. Last year, to try to struggle in working in these areas. One night last summer, I read the 10th anniversary issue of Sojourners magazine, which is a Christian magazine dedicated to issues of peace and social justice. And it was about all the efforts that they had done over 10 years in their ministry of creating an inner-city daycare and neighborhood schools and all the outreach programs that they do in the inner city of Washington, D.C. I remember sitting on my balcony and putting down the magazine and saying, I need to be involved in these areas more. I just felt a spiritual call. And I said, I need to be more involved in some areas, something like that, here in Salt Lake City and in the world or so. And then the thought came to me, I can't do that alone. I'll burn out. Because I know myself and have lived long enough to know that I get involved in things and you work hard and you crash. I thought, I need a community to help sustain and support me in this. I think that's an important Christian point. And then the thought came to me, which I really lamented, I can't expect my ward community to sustain me in this work. That's not what it's about. It wasn't critical, but the ward just isn't of such a commitment and intensity in those areas. So I've begun working with another friend on a group of us who meet weekly, although we haven't met recently, and community is also a very hard thing to work on, where we celebrate each other's journey in working in these areas, and we read scriptures on these areas, and we pray, and we help bear each other's burdens in these areas, and succor each other, and celebrate the internal spiritual journey and struggles that come with something like this. Because I think for us to do it over the long haul, we need to have supporting, sustaining communities, either networks of friends or even associations of friends or something to where we can go and get nourishment and strength and strengthen others in this process of working on these issues. It's a journey that very few of us can walk alone. Maybe some of the saints in the world can, but most of the people, and I'm certainly one of them, need companionship in working on this journey. And so to create time and talents, I think, in terms of giving things, you need to do that. Final thing, which I think is important in continuing work, in creating time and space to work on these things, is whatever one is working on in these areas, whether you're giving a lot of money or you're working in more abstract areas of, say, fundraising or accounting or whatever your talents are that help important causes, it is important to make sure that part of your time and talents may help you confront the people you are trying to attend to, that you have face-to-face work with people on the front lines. That, for several reasons. One is you really do get a spiritual gift from being with them, I have experienced. And the spiritual nourishment from working with individuals increases your motivation and your staying power in working with this. And even more importantly, it helps you have a humility about the work that keeps you from the temptation of self-righteousness, which is really a danger in this area, to think that you're better. You really do come to believe that we're all beggars, and there but for the grace go I. And this is God's work, and it's God's surplus, and I'm here just helping, and we're all in this together. And without that sense of spiritual equality, we're really only feeding our own vanity rather than doing the work of God. And that comes, as I've experienced, primarily from one-to-one work. And finally, I want to conclude with just a story, sort of back to the widow's mite story that I just thought of. When I was at BYU, I was an elders' quorum president and sat in a ward council meeting one day where the Relief Society president informed us about the status of a woman in our ward who wasn't a student, who just got fired from her job and didn't have any money and was sort of eating all the food that her roommates had in her refrigerator and was just having a hard time living. And I really felt for that woman who was trying very hard and just struggling. And I was living a fairly comfortable life. I didn't have much ready cash as a student. But, you know, my parents paid my tuition and they paid my rent. And I could get by, you know, either on writing checks or something, and then telling Dad to put the money in the bank. And so I took all the money that I had to last me for the rest of the month. And it was a real denial, because it meant, like, for the next 3 weeks I'd have no dispendable cash. But I wouldn't really hurt. I just wouldn't be convenient. And I put it in an envelope, and one night, late after midnight, I went to her apartment and tacked it on her door and just began walking away with her name on it. Just began walking away. Silent, anonymous gift, which now I've told the world about. But as I was walking away, something totally unexpected happened. I felt this incredible sense of friendship and love with the Lord. You know, it was just this warm feeling that came over me as I walked away from her apartment. I didn't expect it. I didn't really expect a reward from God. And this wasn't like God said, "Oh, Albert, your sins are forgiven." Or it wasn't like God said, "Oh, you're an acceptable person to me now." No sense of self-validation. It was more of an identifying with the love of God. You know, feeling somewhat of the love that God feels, and partly a sense of friendship with God in this work. It's the most pleasing experience in working on this work. And I think that's why working on spiritual justice must be rooted in a spiritual journey that we're on. Otherwise, we can do it out of secular humanist, so to speak, motivations. But to do it for the long haul, I think we need to have that spiritual sense of humility and friendship and a commitment. But even with those, it is a very hard thing to do, and it requires lowering our standard of living, which everything in American culture tells us not to do. But that is what we are called to do. Thank you.
Well, I've got a lot to get through. Just kidding. Actually, these are some handouts and some information on some local charities. If any of you are interested afterwards, you can come up and view through them and take some handouts if you're interested in doing some volunteer service. And I will go over some of that a little bit later. But Cole and Albert have covered the theological foundations of why social justice is important. And now I'd like to just talk about some of the applications of what we've done in the LA First Ward and explain how the desire to get out in the community and to serve, but the reservations that you have because you think that one person can't make a difference, can blossom into something almost unbelievable. And I have a few people who have been involved in some of the projects, and they're going to be talking a little bit about some of their experiences and their feelings as well. But just give you a brief overview and let you know how I got started in doing community service in the LA First Ward. My relief society at the president at the time was Sue Bergen, and she asked me one day what calling in the ward I was interested in serving. And I said, you know, what I'm really most interested in is getting outside of the ward and doing some community service. It's really important to me that Mormons not just help ourselves, but we make an example of the gospel that we have and share it with the community and let them know who we are and what we're about through our actions and not just our persuasions. So the next week I got a call from the bishop, and they called me to the Christian Community Service Committee, which I had never heard of before, but which turned out to be a wonderful three-year little jig in my life. So some of the projects we started on first were very interesting because I had no idea where to start. I mean, I literally started by opening the phone book and looking at social services and just calling everyone in a list. And I found, much to my disliking, that most of these people that wanted volunteers during the week for a long, committed stay. And I had a large group of volunteers at my disposal through the ward but could only really work on evenings or Saturdays. And so finally I came upon a number for the United Way, and I called them, and there is an organization on the west side called the Volunteer Center of West Los Angeles, and they have volunteer coordinators there, who need volunteers in the in the Los Angeles area call in to these people, and then they hook them up with volunteers. And so through that organization, we got a list of things that were going on at particular times and started to do them. But, you know, even this was just kind of like shooting in the dark, you know, just doing one activity at a time, really not knowing whether it was going to be, you know, if we were really going to be touching people's lives, but at least it was a start. And we started by painting a teen center where kids go after school when their parents work and they need some place to be that's safe. And we went to a teenage runaway shelter and we organized clothes and sorted through them and threw out the ones that were not suitable for wearing and had the others laundered and hung up in size so that when these runaways would come in, they would have clean clothes and clothes that they could go interview for jobs in. Some of the other things we did were Special Olympics, which they had been doing in our ward before, but we continued to do that once a year. And we would go in the mornings, we still do it once a year, go in the morning and feed the athletes, which I'm sure means much more to us than it does to them. But that's an especially humbling experience and one that I think we all look forward to every year. A couple of the other programs that we've been involved in have turned into much bigger than we ever expected, I think. But it was because of these small projects that we did just one time. Somebody else would hear about us, and then they started calling us and asking us if we could get involved in certain things. And I'm going to talk about three of those things now. The first one is the Westside Center for Independent Living, which I serve on their fundraising board. And this is an organization that's dedicated to the physical and the psychological well-being of disabled people, any kind of disability. And they receive counseling and in-house care attendance, whatever these people need to live independently and support themselves if possible, and receive whatever kind of support that they need to live in the society as independently as possible. And this, again, is like Special Olympics, where no matter what you do for them, you end up getting more back. They have an annual fundraiser every year, which Dear Abby writes a column about this organization, and they have a banner, just a Help Call Belize banner, and it sticks up in the windshield of a car. And we go down and work in the mailroom, and we just stuff envelopes and seal them up and send them out. It's the simplest job in the world. But the impact that our group of adults from the LA First Ward has had on these people is tremendous. I didn't think anything of it. You know, we went in there, and everyone's having a great time. 15 or 20 of us got this assembly line going. We had it all systematically down. And one of the volunteers called me the next day, and he said, I've never seen a group of people like that. And he said, and they're Mormons. I thought they were all somber. And you know, what about this dancing thing? You know, I heard they don't dance. And all of their perceptions of what Mormons were and what they stood for and the fact that they help their own community but they don't reach outside of their community was changed by one evening of us volunteering to stuff envelopes. And that was tremendous to me. And especially to walk into that room and see a huge conference table of people in wheelchairs and people with hearing disabilities and blind people and able-bodied from the LA First Ward who came to volunteer, all intermingled and dealing with each other, was really tremendous. And there isn't a time when I go down to the center to volunteer which I don't leave feeling guilty because I've taken more out in perspective and love from them. One of the other activities that we got involved in was an auction. We decided that we needed to raise some money in order to really do some good in the community. So we held a services auction before Christmas 2 years ago to try to raise money for Sub for Santa. And we expected to raise $500 or so and do a little Sub for Santa for some children. And ended up making $2,500, which was a little bit of a surprise to us. And didn't know how to spend all the money, you know, with 2 weeks to Christmas. So we gave half of the money to a needy stake in Los Angeles, where the bishop dispersed the money to the bishops to disperse to the people who really needed the money for Christmas. And the rest of the money we put in a little account. And come along last March, we started working with the homeless down at Santa Monica City Hall. They feed 300 to 500 homeless 6 days a week, actually. And so on one Saturday a month, we began to feed the homeless with that money. And Frances Kay has been actively involved in that project, and she's going to tell us a little bit about her experiences with that.
Like Allison said, we, as a ward, started, she got this program going, and when she was describing it, it just sounded like something that would be really a terrific experience to get involved with. Living in Santa Monica, there are a number of homeless people, and, you know, so often, you know, when people approach you for assistance on a one-to-one basis, you're like, I can't do this, there's just too many people coming at me, and you just can't get in touch with these people. They seem so removed from your experience. So I was personally really excited to work on this project that Allison had started. And originally the commitment was just this one Saturday, and we were going to try that out. And then we've been doing it since last year, and I've been involved in just a way to kind of get the meals going. And like she said, we do it once a month, every Saturday. And originally we were thinking, how are we going to get our ward, who generally bands together more for social purposes than really, you know, service projects. I mean, a one-time shot's fine. But this consistency thing was really, you know, going to pose a problem, I thought, to make any kind of long-term commitment. But when it started going, I was so impressed with how our ward responded. There were too many people in the kitchen to really pull a meal together, and there was too many people at the service line to have a job for everybody. And just how touched some people were about this experience was really kind of revealing to me what a need there is for people to have this opportunity to really serve. And some of the things that really impressed me and was important about this community service was really, as Albert had mentioned, getting face-to-face with what's out there. People were in line as, you know, 300 people would line up. Our people were in a service line behind a, you know, 6-foot table and actually serving the food individually to each person as they come through. And there would be dialogue and exchange with these people just a little bit. Oh, you know, that tastes good. Oh, that's great. Or have some of this. Or how are you doing today? And actually having a conversation with these people that generally, you know, they're really frightened of when they're approached on the street. And the kind of the feedback that we got from the people that were serving was like, wow, first of all, they couldn't believe how many people there were, how many people were in need. But the other thing was how human they were and how, in many respects, they weren't that much different from them. And who was on what side of the table wasn't really, you know, the point that was, you know, the issue that was coming up. And kind of that face-to-face is really important. And also the other sense of building a community within ourselves. Serving together as a group was so important that it really pulled a lot of people together. And it just gave you this personal sense of, you know, that you can make a difference. I mean, even one-on-one, but also as a group, that was really important. The other thing that really I think our ward has learned from is the consistency, that we made this commitment, and there was a point that we were going to say, okay, we've done it for 3 months in a row, you know, let's try other things. You know, there may be other volunteer organizations that need our help. But a group of people really rallied who had become committed to this cause and said, no, you know, we really need to be consistent. And I know it's hard to get singles out, you know, on a Saturday, no doubt, but that we need to be consistent to this particular cause and really hang in there for this group. And every month we get more people than we could really use to come out and help feed the homeless. And I can't remember how many times I've heard people from the pulpit who have gone one day and in their testimony bearing have said that this is probably, that it was a really moving and a very touching experience for them to be able to provide that service and to be part of this group. And it really has touched people's souls. Mostly, I think, on the service end, you know, getting more than you give, but just working together as a group and really working in the community. And the thing that really brought me into this, in this particular service project, was the fact that it wasn't just our own people. It was our opportunity to go, hey, we're Mormons, but we do things for other people. And what was exciting for me and other people that served is it's an interdenominational group. So as we were passing food out in the line, somebody you didn't really know is, oh, where are you from? Oh, I'm from, you know, Temple Bethel. You know, where are you from? I'm from St. Timothy's. That here we were side by side with people of various faiths that all had this desire to serve and felt this importance to work within their community. And that was, I think, what impressed me personally the most, and how I felt really proud to be LDS and part of this group that, regardless of, you know, denomination, you know, really committed ourselves consistently together and as a community. And that was just one of our experiences.
Thank you, Frances Kay. The next project that we're involved in involves a member of the LA First Ward who is a teacher in South Central Los Angeles. And Jill Sargent is with us today, and she came to me one day and said, do you think anyone might be interested in tutoring some of my students? They're reading at a third grade level or less, and they're juniors and seniors in high school. And I said, well, we can try. And we had 50 people come out to tutor, and Jill's going to tell us about some of those experiences now.
I have to start out by saying that I've been really touched with a lot of what's going on, and so it's really close to my heart, so you have to, you know, bear with me. As Allison said, I teach high school in South Central Los Angeles, and most people's first comment is, aren't you scared? And I have to tell you, no, I'm really not. It's true that crime is very high. Poverty is unbelievable. Graffiti is one of the most obvious problems. And apathy is the very biggest problem of all. Just to give you, I teach 10th and 12th grade. My students are 80% Hispanic and 20% Black. They are reading on the average of a third grade level. On the average, their parents' educational level is the eighth grade. And to give you a little bit of an idea of the individuals, on Thursday, as I read individually with them through their papers, writing personal essays, I learned how it feels to be shot from one student, how it feels to be kidnapped from another student. I learned about having babies from another student. I learned about one girl's personal recollections of a troop of guerrilla soldiers taking over their house and ransacking it when she was 6 years old. And I learned how to steal blazers, the cars. And these are not just your average adolescent experiences. I'm very close to my students, and I guess some people aren't comfortable with that. But as I was working with one student named Gustavo, who was very bright, quick thinker, had lots and lots of potential, and I couldn't help him with his geometry class because I was never really very smart in math. And I started thinking, I must know somebody who can help him with geometry because he has to get to college. And I looked around and thought about things. And one time in church, I looked around and I thought, you know, there are a lot of people here who I'm sure are a lot better at geometry than I am. This is a place where we have such a group of talented, unusually highly talented people in one place. And I looked around and I thought, you know, maybe I could find a tutor for Gustavo here. And I know that that's kind of a strange thing to go around asking people, would you be willing to help this boy with his math? And at first I asked a couple of people individually and it got kind of wishy-washy answers. And then I don't know what happened. I just was hit in the head by something. I don't know. I would have had to have been. And I decided, there are a lot of other students that need help too. Why don't if I say that we're doing this for a lot of people, then I'm more likely to make sure that we find somebody to help Gustavo. So, like I said, I approached Allison and asked her if she thought that people might be interested in doing something like this. And the difficulty of this is that it was a long-term commitment for a semester, which is approximately 4 to 5 months. And we asked them to commit for this entire semester to work individually once a week with a student one-on-one. And this is a difficult type of volunteer work to do because people have busy schedules and because there are a lot of obstacles that need to be overcome in volunteering to work in an area that most people are really very afraid of, and that many people don't, even intelligent people, don't feel like they know where to start. And that was something that I felt too. I didn't know where to start. I had never organized a volunteer program. I didn't know what I was doing. It's kind of a seat of the pants sort of thing. And it was a learning process for me. A couple of the things that I learned very strongly from it, I learned, first of all, if you're afraid to do something just because you don't know how, it's never going to get done. If you wait for someone else to start, it might never get done either. So you just kind of have to go in boldly, I guess. We sent around a sign-up sheet of people that might be interested. Then I looked through my students to find the ones that I felt were most in need of help, and also hopefully most receptive. Students with potential who didn't have opportunities otherwise. As I explained to the people who had volunteered to tutor, most people whose parents have been somewhat educated or have older brothers and sisters or who have siblings or something have someone to turn to when there's a problem with the homework or when they don't understand something in class. But when you're the first person in your family that really is learning how to how to read and in English and how to do geometry, there's no one really to turn to. Another thing that was spoken of here at the panel that I have to say that I learned the most difficult way is that it is very necessary to have support groups for this, because I tried to rush in and do it really without any sort of support group, and it was a learning experience, but it would not be something that I would recommend to anyone else. So the support is absolutely vital for that particular the whole product to come out. It's not something that can really be done by any one individual because it's very draining. I would like to tell you just a couple of the really a couple of experiences that tutors had that were inspirational to me. There was one student in my class named David, and David, despite everything I had tried to do, there was no way that I could justify passing David from my English class. And so during the summer, I had spent some time with him individually trying to get him to build up some skills so that he wouldn't be completely lost. Working with David, I realized that he didn't know which number to put on the top when you subtract. And he had passed through 10th grade. There were tests that you need to pass, which are on approximately a fifth grade level, that you need to be able to pass in order to graduate from high school, and there was no way that David could pass these tests. Through this tutoring program, we got David a tutor, and it was one of the magic moments in the program, because David and his tutor had similar tastes in music, and this is something that's important to 15-year-old boys, and so it was somebody that he could identify with. David and his tutor spent time working on math. David learned how to sit down and actually do something because he had never really had any role models around him that completed a project. Alcoholism was a distinct problem in his home. Aside from working on math, they did things together and became friends. Towards the end of February, David completed his math courses that he needed to take to pass high school with a B in one and a C in the other. That's from a boy who 6 months before didn't know which number to put on the top when you subtract. And the thing that was really amazing to me was the bond that had developed between he and his tutor. David called his tutor because there was an emergency situation and he needed someone to talk to. And it turned out that his girlfriend was pregnant and he needed someone to talk to about it. And the tutor made the comment that I started out with as a math tutor and feel like I'm ending up as a grandfather. But a strong bond has been built in there that I think I could see going beyond just the semester and just passing the math credits. There were some of the other situations that worked well. One of the tutors ended up working with seven. She went to work with one girl, and the girl had younger brothers and sisters, and there was a cousin and a neighbor. And she spent 3 hours working with, and I know the student that had been in my class was a drug baby. And so it's pretty good odds that the other six kids probably were too. But she spent 3 hours straight just working with these kids. And that to me is an inspiration of, is an example of really giving of your time and talents with no rewards. The grandmother kept trying to pay her, and she kept saying, no, I don't need any pay. It was a rocky program, and it took a lot out of me working with it, and I don't know how much we're going to continue to try to work with it, but if nothing else, even if nothing else happens, they're the beautiful and bright moments that make something worthwhile. And fear is the greatest obstacle to love, and I think that one day, I would like to see the Lord call his people Zion, and I would like to see that Zion include these tutors and the students.
Thank you, Jill. I'd just like to conclude by saying that it is our responsibility as people with religious sensibilities to give something back for all the blessings that we enjoy, and that we can make a difference, but that we have to act to bring about change. Thank you.
I think we, first of all, I'd like to thank all the panelists for their presentations. I certainly hope that we as a church can feel a sense of community and feel, Albert, I'm thinking that, you know, I lament the fact that you didn't feel that you had the sense of community and support from your ward. And the LA First Ward is I think, a good example, and one I wanted to share with others, that we can, if we take the initiative, I think that we can organize ourselves, and I would hope that the LA First Ward would be an inspiration for us to try and work for social justice through our wards or our other community support structures to provide us with that. We have, I think, about 5 minutes for any questions and comments. If you have a question or comment, can I ask you to, if you don't mind, coming up here, and so I think we're recording this. So could you come up to the microphone, if you wouldn't mind?
I'd like to suggest another way also. I think these are excellent and appropriate. We're trying to do this same type of thing within our stake through the public affairs program, and that we're encouraged in each of your stakes who have the public affairs are encouraged to motivate members to get out in the community and do stuff along with the Relief Society this year with their birthday celebration. But another way, I belong to an organization called Jericho that basically was set up by Catholic individuals. Although the past president was a Latter-day Saint up in Sacramento, but basically what we try to do is work on the system to bring about social justice. And We have lobbyists up in Sacramento who study the laws and promote laws that help to try to help the poor, to bring them health services, to bring them assistance, to aid to dependent families, etc. And of course, you're all aware that the governor has declared war on the poor in our state, and that the governor is really, we'll see in the campaign with this initiative that he's proposed that you're going to see a lot of stuff on TV putting down the poor and everything else. Well, we work to bring pressure on those organizations to provide legislative passage that will help these people. And we call our senators, we call our assemblymen, we write letters, we contact the governor. These types of things. To bring pressure, and if there are enough citizens out there that respond, then things happen, and they've been able to enact a number of important items of legislation this past year to help the poor, in spite of the economy, in spite of the tone of our government. So if any of you are interested in Jericho, I'll be glad to tell you about it afterwards. Okay, if there are no other... Oh, okay, we got a few more comments.
We've got 2 minutes. I just thought I'd offer another suggestion of what my wife and I figured out of what we could do with the classic problem of when people come up to you on the street for money. And I know we have our middle-class prejudices about what they'll do with the money, and we're afraid of their misusing it. And we may be wrong, but we still feel uncomfortable. We give the money, and... So what happened one is that we go to the opera. We live in the San Francisco Bay Area, and we go to the opera and the symphony. And to do that, you have to get off of BART and walk through the Civic Center, which any of you in the Bay Area know has been a gathering place, because at least for a while there, they would let people hang out in the Civic Center Plaza. And... of course, they figure out that people get off BART and go to the symphony and the opera, and they line the way. And we go to the opera on Sunday afternoons, for example, and we always take food with us. And accidentally, on occasion, we'd have food left over, and we'd go back from the opera. We would give out the food as we would go along from our lunches. And that gave us the idea that every day I walk through the Civic Center to get to my office. My wife started making me an extra bag lunch every day. And so when I would go through the Civic Center, I would look out for whoever was there, and I'd go up, and I wouldn't wait to be off to be approached. I would just go up and offer the person a lunch. Sometimes I'd be refused. Rarely I would be refused. As this went on, week after week, month after month, I mean, every day I would go there with a lunch. I got... To be one of the regulars there. I mean, they knew me. They would come up to me and give me the gossip about, you know, so-and-so who was here last week, you know, you always give the lunch to the blonde fellow, you know, he's in the hospital, you know, he got into a fight and someone cut his thumb off, and sure enough, about a week later, he showed up again with a big bandage on his thumb. And there were several instances where they would tell me things that were happening, and there was one man I always called the reader, because... he always just sat there reading books, and he was a homeless, but he sat there on the bench reading books every day. And offered I would approach him and give him the lunch, and he started complimenting me. He said, "Where do you get these lunches that you give me?" I'd say, "My wife wakes an extra lunch for me to give away." And he'd say, "Well, actually, he didn't quite get the idea that it was an extra lunch, because he said, won't she be upset that you're giving away your lunch every day?" And I said, "No, she makes an extra lunch for me to give to whoever needs it." And he started giving me compliments on telling to pass along to her about what was in the lunch. And so now we just try, whenever we go out, we try to keep a granola bar or whatever we can in our pocket, something that'll last, and just to have it ready when someone approaches us for money. To try to give it away. Unfortunately, the earthquake came along and displaced us from our Civic Center building, and our office moved downtown, and they've sanitized the downtown, so now I don't have those people to give the lunch to every day. But if you're walking through an area, that you may consider that as a possibility.
Thank you very much. Appreciate that. Do you want to come up with the last comment, then we'll end? Incidentally, there are some sign-up sheets and some information, as Allison mentioned, that are up here if you're interested.
If any of you are interested in putting your charity dollar somewhere, I have a 15-inch stack of begging envelopes on my desk at home. It's a very difficult problem to know where and when and how much to give. My wife's a soft touch. She gives a little bit to 100 different organizations. I tend to put mine in one big pot. I'm grateful for the idea of the granola bar. I think I'll start carrying one. As a doctor with an HMO treating the Medi-Cal, you talk about the kids not getting their shots and their poverty and so forth. Much of that's due to their social habits. They just don't, even when it's available, they don't come and get their medical care. Even when it's available free. Or they milk the system for all it's worth. They have another baby, they get another so much, 100 a month, and so they tend to milk the system. They're not very grateful patients oftentimes, even when you knock yourself out for them. They're not about to give up their cigarettes and their alcohol and so forth. At least not for the doctor. Maybe some of the rest of you can get next to them and help them. I don't know. I hate to leave this on a kind of a negative, but it certainly is a problem for me and probably the rest of us, and I agree that fear is something we have to overcome on this. I personally am a retired physician, and I'm involved in a little in hospice work now, which is help and care for the dying. Unfortunately, I don't do any medical practice anymore. Even though I keep up my license, I can't afford the malpractice insurance to protect me from the lawyers. So I'm frustrated there, too. Got any ideas, any of you? Let's have them out.
I guess my only response to that would be one of my favorite scriptures, King Benjamin in Mosiah. He said, perhaps you shall stay your hands, saying to yourself that these people have brought this upon themselves. But King Benjamin then tells us that those who do that are under even greater condemnation. You know, as Albert mentioned, you know, we are, and it's echoing King Benjamin's address, we are we not all beggars? Again, I'd like to thank the panelists and appreciate all your attendance, and we'll close. Thank you.